President Trump says Iran did it. He says Iran carried out the attack on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman yesterday. The president made the statement during a nearly 50-minute interview on Fox and Friends this morning.
You know they did it because you saw the boat. I guess one of the mines didn't explode, and it's probably got essentially Iran written all over it. And you saw the boat at night trying to take the mine off and successfully took the mine off the boat, and that was exposed, and that was their boat, that was them.
President Trump is referring to a rather grainy video released by the U.S. military that purportedly shows Iranian special forces removing an unexploded mine from the side of one of the damaged oil tankers. Hassan Rouhani, Iran's president, denied that Tehran had anything to do with the attacks. Jim Walsh is here and now security analyst. He's with the Security Studies Program at MIT. Hello, Jim.
Good to be with you.
So set this up for us. What exactly happened between these two tankers in the Gulf and what led up to it?
Well, what happened is we've had two tankers from two different countries that were disabled by mines. Now, there's still some dispute about that. The Japanese owner of one of the tankers said that he believed, based on eyewitness testimony from his staff, that a shell or projectile of some kind had hit his ship. And there's a debate, you know, could it be a torpedo? Was it a floating mine? Was it an attached mine? I mean, the video sort of suggests that if the video is real, that it's an attached mine. So we've had two tankers disabled. No one killed, no one injured. But this is in a broader context. You'll remember a few weeks ago, another couple of tankers were attacked. And then really the starting point for all this, if we really are trying to get to the origins, is that the U.S. adopted a policy, President Trump's policy, of maximum pressure, including trying to drive Iran's oil exports to zero. The president is trying to strangle Iran economically, to destroy its economy. And, you know, surprise, surprise, rather than simply lying on the ground and saying, kick me again, you know, it may be that Iran is pushing back. Now, it may be that there are others who are responsible for that. This is a so-called false flag operation. But I just don't think, you know, we have enough information to be able to assess that at this point.
But if these two tankers, neither of these two tankers were flagged to the United States, so why would Iran want to attack two tankers that had nothing to do with Donald Trump, presumably?
Of course. So the reason is that Iran has said, Iran has said for some time that if it's denied the ability to export oil in the Persian Gulf, then no one is going to be able to export. These are their words, not mine. And it's a way for them to sort of raise the cost of this maximum pressure policy that's being enforced upon them.
By trying to basically scuttle or at least interrupt any kind of oil flow
to get some leverage. Exactly. I mean, in some ways, this is like a fight, you know, at a sporting event. Some guy throws a punch, the other guy retaliates, the ref sees the guy retaliating and calls the foul. Now, of course, no one should be punching anyone and no one should be hurting tankers in the Gulf. But the reason why we are here in the first place is that we're trying to deny Iran any ability to export its main, the backbone of its economy, which is oil.
Well, in the case of sports, there's usually a pretty good quality video. In this case, there is a rather grainy video, which you have seen. Does it tell us anything?
You know, I don't think it tells you that much. It is grainy. You can't really tell the identity of the people. I mean, you know, if it was a false flag, and again, I have some doubts about this, you know, people would be in a boat in uniforms that were of the country they were trying to implicate. It's weirdly cropped. It sort of starts way, you know, we don't see the boat coming. We only see the video of someone trying to remove something, and then we don't see where the boat goes afterwards. So hardly conclusive. But I would urge our listeners to not focus on this. This is sort of the equivalent of a horse race coverage for politics. Who's ahead? Who's behind? And in this case, it's the whodunit. Who is responsible for this? And we have this exciting, grainy video to look. This is a distraction. The question is not who. The question is why. Why is this happening? And it's happening because we're pursuing a policy that's intended to strangle Iran. Iran is pushing back. And if we continue down this path, we're going to end up in yet another war in the Middle East. That's the big question. Why are we doing this?
So I wonder if you can answer that, because at the same time that the president is blaming Iran, he's also talking about negotiating with Iran.
Yeah. So he's gone back and forth on this, right? First, when he announced that he was pulling out of the deal, we want to negotiate, but we're not ready to do it. Then a couple of weeks ago, when we had a couple of these incidents, he said, call me. You know, he gave out his phone number and said, call me. Imagine you're in a relationship, a business relationship, a family relationship, a romantic relationship, and you have a commitment with someone. And that person then walks out on the commitment and not only walks out, insults you, threatens you, hurts you, threatens your allies, and tries to steal all the money out of your bank account. And then they say, call me.
Come for dinner.
Yeah. I mean,
do you think the United States, the President Trump, wants a military confrontation with Iran?
I don't think the president has a strategic bone in his body. And so I think there are days when he said, no, I don't want to get tangled up in a war in the Middle East. And then there are going to be other days when he says, I need to hit back. I there's nothing in this presidency that suggests to me a through curve here that suggests a strategy. I think he's all, as he has said himself, a counterpuncher. He goes with the gut. I don't think he has a plan. I think there are other people in the administration who have a plan. You know, the National Security Advisor and the Secretary of State have called for regime change in the past. So I think, you know, anything could happen on any given day. But the general trend is towards accidental war or intentional war.
And you know this part of the world very well. The chances of this happening accidentally, some kind of confrontation?
Well, what happens is something happens, and then each side feels compelled to respond, to save face. Or each side feels, well, if I take it up a notch, the other side will back down. And in some ways, President Trump sort of encouraged the Iranians to have that view, because when this whole thing went down again 2 weeks ago, he sort of caved. You know, sort of rushed to say, oh, I want to talk. Well, what did the IRGC, how did they think about that? They probably thought, hey, this guy's a softie. And then they do something and then you're off to the races. So that's why it's so dangerous.
Jim Walsh, Here and Now security analyst with the Security Studies Program at MIT. Nice to have you here.
Good to be with you.
To Europe now, where the rise of populism is changing the political landscape across the continent. Most far-right parties are still minor players in policymaking, but that is not the case in Austria. The far-right Freedom Party shared power with conservatives until a scandal brought down the government last month. As Joanna Kakissis reports, the party is still popular and could make a comeback.
When the government fell last month, some of the loudest cheers at a celebration in Vienna came from Karolina Kotsan, who's part of a group called Grannies Against the Right.
We are all older women, and we all experienced a different time, an open society.
She says that open society changed in late 2017, when the conservatives invited the far-right Freedom Party into government. This gave license to hateful values.
Radicalism and anti-Semitism and racism, society in general, it all moved more to the right and even more to the extreme right.
She leads the crowd in a song about grannies fighting wolves.
The war is not won, yeah?
She worries the far right will return after elections this September, despite a recent scandal involving former Freedom Party leader Heinz Christian Strache. He was forced to resign as vice chancellor last month after a 2017 video of him on a Spanish island surfaced. In the video, he seems to be making boozy deals with a Russian woman, posing as the niece of an oligarch close to the Kremlin. The tape was a trap, and it brought down the government. The scandal shook up the Freedom Party's leadership, but not its affinity for Russia. At the 19th century era Imperial Cafe, longtime party member Johannes Hubner explains the worldview.
It's in our interest to have a balanced worldwide network of allies and not to be a U.S. colony. The thing is in Europe there is an overwhelming U.S. influence through NATO, or through the control of the financial system, through the media, through the entertainment industry.
Other far-right parties in Europe share this pro-Russia stance. Reinhard Heinisch, a political scientist at the University of Salzburg, lists other traits in common.
They're also an anti-immigration party. They're an anti-foreigner party. So they are nativist. They are unabashedly nationalist.
And this means something in Austria, the birthplace of Adolf Hitler.
When it comes to interpreting Austrian history, there are certainly many in the Freedom Party who see the defeat of Nazi Germany not as a victory for democracy, but see it as a defeat for their cause.
Many Austrians played a role in the Holocaust after Hitler annexed their country in 1938. Austria, though, did not go through the same process of re-education as Germany.
I mean, there was an anti-Nazi political consensus in the years after 1945, but there was never a consensus that you cannot cooperate politically with the far right.
That's Bernard Weidinger at the Documentation Center for the Austrian Resistance in Vienna.
So the two big parties, they've always been flirting with the far right. And that, of course, contributed massively to normalize policies of this party.
So today, the Freedom Party enjoys the support of nearly one in five Austrians. Like Kurt Blind. He's a retired IT administrator who runs a monthly meeting of party faithful at a beer and schnitzel restaurant in Vienna. We may not have as many members as the other parties yet, he says, but each month we grow. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Vienna.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Emberwave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, own your temperature.
There was an underground culture in New York City during the 1980s, and among its hallmarks were gay and transgender drag balls. The FX TV series called Pose follows members of New York's drag ball scene. The first season of Pose was set in the late 1980s, and the second season fast forwards to 1990. Both track the lives of the show's characters during the heat of the AIDS crisis. NPR's Eric Deggans has been watching the new season. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Could you first reintroduce us to the drag ball scene in New York and who was part of it?
Sure. So anybody who knows the Madonna song Vogue and that video will get a sense of what the drag ball scene was like. It was contests where different groups of folks would dress up in these costumes, and it was a way to have a chosen family for people who were often rejected by their biological family when they would come out as transgender or come out as gay. Pose does a great job of sort of recreating that whole scene and giving you a sense of what it felt like to be in the middle of it.
Yeah, and you say in terms of season one, there are drag shows that were, quote, so fabulous it'll make your eyes hurt. But that was contrasted with a lot of grit and hardship, and you just alluded to some of that. What happens in season two?
Well, season two sort of fast forwards to 1990, and we're in the heart of the AIDS crisis. The lead character in Pose, played by N.J. Rodriguez-Blanca, is HIV positive. And in the first episode of the new season, she's talking to her medical professional about the progression of her disease, and we get a sense of what people knew and what they didn't know about how HIV and AIDS worked. And her medical professional is played by Sandra Bernhardt. So let's check it out. We've got a clip.
So I have AIDS now?
But it's just a number. It's a way of flagging how much care a patient needs.
No, I've been feeling fine. I've been feeling amazing, actually. Last winter, when my kids got sick, I didn't have a sniffle at all.
I mean, sometimes you can't tell what HIV is doing to your immune system.
So I'm dying.
No, you're not dying. You still have plenty of T cells to fight with, but we can't let those numbers drop any lower.
And back then, there weren't medications available that could help rebuild your immune system like we have now.
So it really was a death sentence.
Yes, it really was a horrific thing that happened to people, and it took longer to figure out what was going on, in part because there was such a stigma attached to getting the disease in the first place, and some official outlets, including the U.S. government, were dragging their feet in terms of providing resources for research and for treatment.
Eric, I want to ask you about some of the other actors in this series. The show made an icon out of one of its lead actors, Billy Porter. Let's listen to a clip of his character, the announcer, Pray Tell, who's getting in the face of a trans woman who didn't show up for a protest.
You are more concerned about winning a trophy than you are about our government spreading lies about us in an effort to kill us. And you want to know why they want us dead? Because we're black and we're brown and we're queer. They don't give a about us. So we better start caring about ourselves. Show up for your lives. Wake up!
So Billy Porter has also gained fame for appearing on red carpets in tuxedos that then morph into evening gowns, as I think he did on the Tony Awards just the other night.
Yeah, I witnessed his finery in person at the Peabody Awards just last month. The brother knows
around.
How to bring it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what's amazing, what's great about Billy is that he is a bridge between that scene, being a person who was there when it was actually happening, and now playing a character in the show. But yeah, there are a lot of great new performers. I mean, Pose makes history by featuring the most transgender actors and most gay series regular characters in a scripted series in mainstream television. So I talked about MJ Rodriguez, who plays Blanca, the main character. And there's this powerful scene where Billy Porter's character and Blanca go to a place where they are interring unclaimed bodies. You know, all the people who died from AIDS are sort of placed in these unmarked graves, just boxes and boxes kind of stacked up in these large holes in the ground. And it's the flip side of this joyous celebration that the drag ball competitions are. And it perfectly sort of encapsulates the two worlds that this series is negotiating. It's really an amazing thing to see, an amazing thing to see recreated if you're old enough to remember what it was like when it was happening.
The series is called Pose. It's entering its second season on FX. And before we let you go, Eric, the weekend is upon us. Do you have any good picks for good viewing over the weekend?
There's an interesting series called City on a Hill that starts on Showtime featuring Kevin Bacon as this corrupt FBI cop in Boston. And if you have extra time, you can always go back and see When They See Us on Netflix. People are still talking about it. You know, some people are losing jobs and resigning from positions over the impact from the series, which retells the story of the Central Park Five from their perspective. There's a lot of great stuff out there that's come to television in the last couple of weeks, so it's a good time to catch up.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, we have our assignment. Thank you very much, Eric.
Always a pleasure.
And here's a taste of what it sounded like last night in Toronto. Toronto Raptors fans going wild as their team beat the Golden State Warriors 114-110 to win the NBA championship. This is the first time a team from outside the U.S. has won the NBA title. And in fact, it's the first major sports title for a Canadian team in a quarter century. The CBC's David Common joins us now from Toronto. And David, I hear you were out on the streets last night with people celebrating this victory. Did Canada like wake up with one big hangover today?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And I would say it's not just the city of Toronto. This really was a cross-country thing. There were viewing parties in stadiums and arenas and homes and bars and restaurants from coast to coast to coast, like even into our Arctic region. There were people up and loud and excited, but certainly on the streets, hundreds of thousands of people who'd either been in Jurassic Park outside the arena where the Raptors normally play or had themselves been at home or wherever and were just overjoyed.
Yeah, I bet. Well, you know, I was going to say, in the United States, when a team wins a championship, it's a victory for the city or the state where that team plays. But as you say, this is a win for the entire country. Can you talk more about just how captivated all of Canada was?
You know, I think there's a lot of bandwagon people. I'm certainly a bandwagon person. I do go to Raptors games, but like one a season, and I don't know all the stats and all the players and everything about them. I certainly know a lot more now, and I would suggest there's a lot of people right across the country who are like that. But at the same time, in the Toronto area itself, I look back to 1992 when the Toronto Blue Jays won the World Series for the first time. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, that was the moment where we said, you know, Toronto, we could be a world-class city. Canada, we can actually compete here. It was this sort of an inferiority complex thing going on. And there was a little bit of that as well with the Raptors. But the city has changed so much since the Jays won that World Series. It's grown by 2 million people, and the kinds of people are different. It's much more diverse.
Yeah.
We're much richer as a result. And so to look out on the street compared to when I was in like early high school back in 1992 to today, it just looks different. Hmm. Same kind of energy, much bigger crowd, but a total togetherness. And in a world where we are so divided, it's just nice for people of all backgrounds to kind of be together and hugging each other. And there was that. I was on the air last night.
Sure.
People were coming up and just hugging.
Well, this was a very close game. It came down to the final seconds. The Raptors were playing a team in the Warriors that had been to the NBA Finals for five straight years. Did fans feel confident that they could pull this out and win the series?
You know, I think there was a lot greater confidence on Monday for Game 5. I think there was a feeling of certainty that, of course, they had to win at that point. And ultimately, they didn't. They lost by 1 point. And so last night, people came into Jurassic Park and other places, perhaps with a lot of hope, but with less absolute certainty that this was going to happen. And then as the game progressed, like it was tight through most of the game. Even into that final minute, a complete nail biter. Mm. So where I was in Jurassic Park, this area right outside the arena, it was tense. Like it went from really excited to really, really calm. To give you an idea, Drake,
the rapper,
the rapper who's from Toronto and is this icon for the Raptors and is at so many of the games and has been to so many of the games, whether it's in Oakland or here in Toronto through this final series. He was sitting on this stage in Jurassic Park with his entourage, and he was sitting for most of the game. In that final minute, he was up. He was up the entire time, and that kind of energy you felt not just in Jurassic Park, but in all the surrounding streets where people had gathered in front of big TVs, hundreds of thousands of people.
So the Raptors' big star, Kawhi Leonard, he was the most valuable player for this series, but he's also now a free agent. What's the sense there? Is Leonard staying? Is he leaving?
We don't want to talk about it. That's
the
sense.
We
don't want to talk about it. Yeah.
Should we just go on to the next question?
I think the only question to Kawhi Leonard here during the playoffs seems to have been, have you bought a house in Toronto yet? Have you bought a house in Toronto yet? In fact, there's a condo developer who's offered him a penthouse suite for free.
Oh, come on.
Just
he doesn't
as long
need that.
As he stays. No, he doesn't need that. But, you know, it gives you the sense of the desire to have this guy stay and not see this team broken up. I don't know what happens. Mm. And there'll be lots of talking about that, but it probably won't be till after Monday, the victory parade.
Yeah, let the party go on. That's the CBC's David Common speaking with us from Toronto, where I guess now the question across Canada is, when will your NHL teams win a championship? David, thanks so much.
No problem. And it doesn't matter as much. The country's shifting. The country's shifting in terms of what it likes.
Been a bustling season for retailers in the U.S. The Commerce Department today reported strong gains in sales in May, and this morning's report also revised the March and April numbers upward. That's a good sign for the economy, but experts say there are clouds gathering on the horizon. Mike Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Lisa.
So tell us about the retail numbers. What is driving Americans to shop more this spring?
Well, you know, that consumer element of the economy, which is supremely important, is still pretty strong. If you look at unemployment, it remains at an almost 50-year low. Consumer confidence was another report that came out today. And those readings remain near some of the highest levels of this century. And also you have gasoline prices remain pretty tame, down a little bit compared to this time last year. So all in all, the consumer is sort of holding firm at this point, despite, like you said, some uncertainty about other elements of the economy.
Yeah, so it appears that the higher prices because of tariffs on China are not yet having an effect on consumers. consumer behavior. But despite the good news, that hasn't stopped Wall Street from worrying. Morgan Stanley is saying business conditions are on par with 2008, the year of the financial crisis, the year it first began. Tell us more about what they're seeing.
Yeah, so what Morgan Stanley does is it creates an index that's basically an aggregation of a bunch of different economic signals from the services part of the economy, the manufacturing part of the economy, and that ever-important job market. And all of them did cool recently, so they're gauge of sort of the big picture did take a big dip. It was actually the biggest drop on record, I believe, and as you said, to the lowest level since 2008. So as you pointed out, despite this consumer remaining buoyant, there are what appears to be softening patches in the rest of the economy.
A lot of investors were thinking the Federal Reserve would cut interest rates in July to keep the economy humming along. Is that still likely?
It still appears to be the base case for traders. You can sort of suss out the probability of a rate increase or a rate cut based on what the market for short-term interest rates show. And right now it's about an 85 or 86% probability priced into those markets of a interest rate cut in July. Now, that said, not everyone is convinced. We just had David Kostin of Goldman Sachs on Bloomberg Television this week saying he's not convinced. He's not sure that the Fed actually will cut rates between now at the July meeting. And there's a lot that can happen between now and July. So we'll have to sort of stand by and watch.
I wonder what's happening in China because things there are slowing down. Industrial output growth slowed to its weakest point since 2002, but it still grew about 5%. How long can China keep growth at a level like that?
Right. So obviously they are feeling some of the effects of the trade tensions with the U.S. But you have to remember, China has a lot more flexibility as far as the government responding and introducing stimulus into the economy just because the way the government is set up there. The head of China can sort of pull a lot of different levers to boost demand in the economy that would take a lot of political wrangling in the U.S. to pull off. So I suspect China will continue to respond and have the government end of things boost the demand that is waning in the private sector.
Good to talk to you as always. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Lisa.
There were some dire predictions yesterday on Capitol Hill about the future of technology. Former FBI Special Agent Clint Watts went before the House Intelligence Committee to explain the risk of deep fakes or doctored videos on the internet that appear to be real.
Over the long term, deliberate development of false synthetic media will target U.S. officials, institutions, democratic processes with an enduring goal of subverting democracy and demoralizing the American constituency. In the near and short term, circulation of deepfakes may incite physical mobilizations under false pretenses, initiating public safety crises and sparking the outbreak of violence.
That is one of many issues facing tech companies today that have led to calls for more government regulation. And that is why Congress is now holding a series of high-profile hearings. So how does all this look to the man behind one of the original tech giants? Bill Gates is co-founder of Microsoft. He's also a philanthropist with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which is an NPR funder. Mr. Gates, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And let's start with the hearings on Capitol Hill this week, looking into the power of tech giants like Google, Facebook, and Amazon. Do you think these companies are monopolies?
Well, they certainly have high market shares in some of the areas they work in, and they have impacts on a lot of sectors of the economy. And they become, you know, key tools for communication and even getting news. So, you know, they're important companies.
So important companies, but how much regulation should the federal government have over these companies? Is there not enough?
Well, certainly in areas where, you know, people are using social media for bullying, you know, where you have foreign actors doing election-related activities, you know, even the companies involved say that given the mainstream role, there is room for election-related or child protection or privacy-type rules.
And what does good regulation look like to you?
Well, each of those areas is complex. You have examples coming out of Europe that you can look at on the privacy front. In some of these areas, it's new ground.
A number of 2020 candidates on the Democratic side who are running for president have called for breaking up these tech companies. I want to listen to a little bit from Elizabeth Warren, who's speaking here in New York City in March.
They think they can scoop up all of our personal data and sell it to whoever they want for whatever purposes. They think they can run their business to just roll right over every small business, every entrepreneur, every startup that might threaten their position. And what does our government in Washington do? Nothing.
So do you agree with Elizabeth Warren that some of these companies should be broken up?
Well, generally you've got laws in the country and you ask companies to adhere to those laws. I'm not aware people are saying that they've broken laws in such a way that the remedy would be to do that. It doesn't seem like just going around breaking up companies solves privacy issues.
I want to ask you something else that I heard today. Facebook engineers have created an artificial intelligence system that clones the voices of famous people, including you. So I want to play this recording of the Bill Gates AI impersonator. He's reading a phrase that says, "A cramp is no small danger on a swim." It's a phrase, as you probably know, that engineers use to test AI programs. So let's listen to that.
"A cramp is no small danger on a swim."
Okay, so there it is. Bill Gates, what do you think about that? Pretty good.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt that technology can synthesize speech now. And you have to think, where is that helpful and where is it inappropriate?
Right. What do you think? Are you concerned with the direction that some technology is taking? I mean, is something that, like what we just heard, a risk that worries you?
If it's used in the wrong way, certainly the distrust in news media it's got to be a concern for everyone, and this so-called deep fake capability could make that worse.
These are these fake videos, deep fake, they're called, you're referring to there.
Yeah, either video or audio, yes.
Listen, I want to ask you about another issue that I know is very important to you. You're headed to Capitol Hill later this month to talk to lawmakers about the Trump administration's proposed cuts to the State Department. What is your concern, and have you spoken to the president about this?
Well, I think the United States should be incredibly proud how, on a bipartisan basis, the support for health aid, including PEPFAR, which went after HIV, and Global Fund, you know, they've kept over 10 million people alive that would be dead today. They've allowed these African countries a chance to get their health systems organized to make it less likely that epidemics start in those countries. And so I think, given the strength of the economy, I think the U.S. should at least maintain, if not increase, these budget items. You know, I think the Congress will override the proposed budget cut, but I'm going there to talk about this because I get to see this work in the field. I get to see that the money is very well spent. And so I think it'd be a tragedy if there were cuts.
But in defense of the cuts, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has said that cutting back on the aid will allow other countries to be more self-reliant. What do you think about that? I mean, why should the United States taxpayer be investing in those sorts of issues?
Well, you're saving lives for very small amounts of money. And certainly the Global Fund is fantastic at requiring countries to finance along with the United States as much as they can. But this is government at its best, saving lives, lifting up countries, you know, avoiding instability and epidemics that would threaten U.S. citizens. If this was done on a bipartisan basis, starting under President Bush, boy, if you can't support this, it's hard to know what you can support.
And you've spent something like $10 billion on global health initiatives? And I know you spend a lot of money investing on issues in the United States as well, but do people ever ask you, you know, why is it that you spend so much time and effort on foreign countries as opposed to some of the issues here in the United States? Like, are you doing enough, for instance, to solve poverty here?
Well, I don't think even the U.S. government has solved poverty. We're very involved in U.S. education and trying to make sure that no matter what your background is, that you get a great education. At the same time, you know, we believe that the deaths of children that, you know, were up over 12 million a year back in 1990, the fact that that's been cut in half now is giving countries and places like Africa a chance to grow their economy and become self-sufficient. And so, you know, we've stepped in and global health is a gigantic program for us because we do think those human lives have value.
Hmm. Some Democrats who are running for president have said that there should be a wealth tax, a tax on the richest Americans. Is that something you'd be willing to pay?
Well, I think taxes can be more progressive. You know, if the government's going to take on the increases in medical costs and, you know, eventually not let the deficit get too big, there are, you know, there's a need to find revenue, and I think that can be done in a progressive way. A wealth tax in particular is complicated to implement, but, you know, if that's part of a progressive tax plan that the country wants, then, you know, that's great.
What do you think? Would that impact philanthropy at all if the richest Americans were paying more money in taxes? Do you think they'd be giving more, less of their money away to charity?
Well, the first thing is to make sure the state, which provides education and health and roads and justice, that it's properly financed to do the things that the voters want it to do. Whether that leaves room for deductions for philanthropy, people are going to give money no matter what the tax treatment of philanthropy is. Under certain tax structures, they'd give less. You know, I do think the estate tax is a good tax. You know, it could be even higher. That has led to some, you know, very good philanthropic giving. But first, you got to figure out your taxes, and then, you know, the philanthropic impact comes after that.
How closely are you watching the race for president? Is there somebody that you like so far?
Well, I don't follow the speeches of all 24 candidates. You know, I'm fairly private about, you know, my political approach because, you know, our foundation really, you know, has engaged and will engage with all administrations.
Bill Gates, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
A story that highlights the concerns that many Muslims have about their safety here in the U.S. In May, there was an arson attack on a mosque in New Haven, Connecticut. It came as Muslims were observing the holy month of Ramadan. That arson attack and the recent mass shootings at houses of worship is prompting some leaders to take action. Officials at another mosque in Connecticut have hired more guards to patrol its Sunday school. And as Connecticut Public Radio's Vanessa De La Torre reports, students there aren't just learning about Islam. They're being taught how to respond to misconceptions about their faith.
When I make a mistake with names, bear with me. All right, who's next?
At the Muslim Sunday school in Berlin, Connecticut, Dr. Reza Mansour is coaching a class of mostly teenagers on how to be what he calls modern voices of Islam.
By the way, assalamu alaikum. If you use an Arabic term and you don't translate, dinged 1 point, okay? So assalamu alaikum means God's peace be with you all.
Mansour is president of the school's mosque, the Islamic Association of Greater Hartford, and he's big on translating Islamic phrases and words. Take the word jihad, for instance. It means a struggle, usually a personal, spiritual one. But when you hear the word jihad in the media, he says it's almost always associated with extremists who commit violence in the name of Islam. And when Islam is viewed as a threat, that makes Muslims a target.
Just imagine someone calling you a terrorist and telling you to go home.
Issa bin Salem is 17. He's in the Sunday school class.
I had one of my friends say that they were scared to come to the masjid because they were afraid that they were going to be shot on.
Recently, their mosque had an active shooter training with the local police department. It's one of the security measures they've taken since the attacks at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh and at the two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. But when Mansour talks about security, he also talks a lot about changing the narrative. He tells his students that Islamophobia is driven in part by false information. So he wants them to correct those misconceptions that Muslims are anti-American.
you are the next generation of Muslims, to be able to show that Islamic values and American values are completely compatible.
After 9/11, Mansour founded the Muslim Coalition of Connecticut, a group he started to counter the anti-Muslim rhetoric that he says is perpetuated in the media. The teenage students in this Sunday school grew up after 9/11, and soon they'll be heading off to college. So today they're practicing being modern voices of Islam by having a debate. The topic is whether America is the best place to practice Islam.
And you can bring Islamophobia, rhetoric, media, all of that into it.
They split into groups. One team leans heavily on the constitutional protections for religious freedom. Aisha Pasha says that's nice and all, but
it's not the government that's going into mosques or synagogues and holding mass shootings. It's the people that believe in these xenophobic ideas.
Students also bring up the so-called Muslim travel ban by President Trump. Despite that, Mansour says he still thinks America is a great place to practice Islam, that it remains a safe haven for immigrants like himself. Mansour came from Sri Lanka almost 30 years ago after his medical school there was bombed. He's now a cardiologist.
We don't want the Muslim ban and the Islam hates America and stuff to change this nation that welcomes immigrants and that has made America such a beautiful country. All right, good job, guys. Time for pizza.
Outside, a security guard is seen patrolling the property. Student Nissa Muhammad says she feels safe at her mosque. But as a high schooler in Connecticut who wears a headscarf, she says she's had a deal with people calling her a terrorist.
My friend and I, who also wears a scarf, we took our time to explain to them that our religion does not motivate or promote violence and that we're a religion of peace.
Like Muhammad, Amin Parks is one of the only Muslims at his high school. He says he tries to be a good ambassador for his faith, just like he's been taught in Sunday school. But when an incident involving Muslims happens out in the world, Parks is expected to answer for it.
There's a lot of stereotypes that go along with that as well, a lot of racist jokes and things like that. So, I mean, I try to clear things up, but a lot of people you just can't change. They're really stubborn.
So Parks says he tries to change minds by just being himself.
It's best just to show people who you really are and stuff like that, and if they take it, they'll take it, but if not, just try not to fuel the fire.
Mansour, the teacher, says people of all religions are welcome to visit the mosque. And if his students come away from class feeling empowered in their identity as Muslims and as Americans, he says he'll call that a success. For Here and Now, I'm Vanessa De La Torre.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.